Welcome to Communicate Like You Give a Damn, the podcast. Our guests share their stories and approaches to embedding diversity, equity, and inclusion in communications because, I mean, let's be honest, we know the power of language. And language leads to behavior. So thank you. Thank you for joining us in leveling up your communications. I'm your host, Kim Clark, and DEI communications, it's kind of my thing. So let's get into it. Let's learn more about how to communicate like you give a damn.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Communicate Like You Give a Damn. And I'm your host, Kim Clark. And it's a real pleasure to be here. We're going to get a voice from Tyler. And I was just sharing with our guests before we started to record that there's so many headlines and stories about what's going on in higher ed, especially from recent SCOTUS decisions. However, not enough from actually voices within, especially those who are holding responsibilities of diversity, equity, and inclusion within higher education. So communicators, we do as communicators, especially if we are working within institutions such as higher education in the United States. That's going to be a big part of our conversation here. But first, we're going to hear a very powerful story of how our guest got to be where he is today. So Dr. Brian Samuel is our guest. Dr. Samuel, and thank you for the permission to say Brian moving forward. But thank you so much for being on Communicate Like You Give a Damn. We can't wait to hear your story and your sage advice on what we need to be doing as communicators and how we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion in a pretty contentious time, especially specifically around the messaging of diversity, equity, and inclusion. Because one of the things that I found interesting is especially over the last 4 years, it's been this demand on the work. And now we're having to change how we're talking about it as well as the work. That's the new call to action, if you know, in response to a lot of the pushback that we've been seeing. So with that, please introduce yourself, and then I would love to talk a little bit more about the story that you've shared and offered.
Thank you. As you mentioned, Kim, thank you for having me on the show. I am Dr. Brian Samuel, and I've been in higher education for 30 years now, beginning as a graduate assistant in student support services back in 1993, and had a number of different jobs along the diversity, equity, and inclusion continuum. Back when we knew it as, more of the affirmative action, multicultural affairs, and you know, those type of titles. So, and support programs and things of that nature. So I've been in the business a little while. My story is I grew up in the housing projects in Knoxville, Tennessee, projects called Lonsdale. I'm first generation college graduate, certainly an African-American male, and I'm a student with a disability, and we were very poor. And, you know, back in the days that I started college, back in the 80s, 1988 to be specific, you had to pay to apply to school. You had to pay for financial aid. You had to apply and send some money in with your application and things. So, you know, things were very stringent, to say the least, and very challenging. And so I believe that communication played a huge and pivotal role in where I am today. Effective communication, and more specifically, being able to help university leaders, decision makers, and things of that nature understand diverse perspectives and how they impacted students in marginalized populations.
I know there's more underneath the surface of that story there. And I'd love to hear more, especially because you are the author of Finding Myself, A Journey from the Projects to the PhD. Now, any good storyteller, communicator loves a good alliteration. So thank you for that gift. And so, please share with us more about your story. And this is something that I would really like communicators to listen to in a way of, you know, when there's awareness months or heritage months, there's always this kind of storyline of the first X or the only X. And one of the pieces of advice that I give to communicators and consultants for, especially around awareness months, et cetera, is to, if you're going to do that, you got to talk about the oppressed system. You got to talk about what's lacking. Why did it take so long for a person to become, you know, the first X? You have to talk about the environment because it's not about the person. You know, I mean, it's everything about the person because of tenacity, resilience, that whole storyline. But however, why, you know, we have to be looking at what's the systems that are at fault for holding back from truth, you know, from a, you know, education access. That's what the E is, you know, just looking at what the E is about and talking about the social context. So we have to own that that is a part of our history that has held people back and withholding access to opportunity. And so your story is powerful, and I want communicators to consider the environment of why it's such an amazing story. We need to question that from a historical standpoint, and we need to look at those systems that made it difficult. And so I was moved by your story. And we have to be really honest about how effed up the systems are and that how many more people are being, you know, not given the opportunity to really shine and contribute all of the talent and all of the potential that is out there waiting to be realized. So tell us about your story.
Yeah, without question, there are millions of young people who are being systemically excluded from access and opportunity. And, you know, if it wasn't for a little tenacity and resilience, I could have very easily been one of those. As I mentioned earlier, I grew up in the housing projects and it was, you know, very crime infested. I'm a first generation college graduate. My mother was a single parent raising three kids. And by the time I was 19 years old, 18, 19, there was three kids and two grandkids, right? So, and she was washing dishes, making a measly $3.30 an hour. I was washing dishes, making $3.30 an hour. And one day a friend committed a crime and robbed a person and left the person for dead and that kind of thing. And he eventually went to prison. And so my mother, recognizing that he and I were really close friends, came to me and asked me to find something to do with my life. And she said, "You're young, you're handsome. I don't know much about the military or education programs or colleges and universities, but there got to be something out there you can do. You know, you're smart and so forth and so on." And so I decided I'd go to college. And it just so happens that the following day after she had that 20-second conversation, it changed my life. I just totally changed my life. And it changed the trajectory of our family, quite frankly, because quite a few of my cousins and what have you have gone on to get college degrees and things of that nature as well. And everybody's doing really well as a result of that one conversation. So I went to school the next day, and there was an admission counselor from the University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. And I asked my second period teacher if I could go hear what he had to say. And even though I wasn't on the college track and, you know, wasn't seemed to have a whole lot of potential and that kind of thing, she let me go. And so he talked about all the things at the college and what have you. And I decided I'd go or at least apply to go. Right. Save for the fact that I made a 12 on ACT. And so when I got this 12 on the ACT, all the colleges I applied to said, "No, we're not going to admit you because you never graduate. And it wouldn't be fair to me to admit me knowing I would never graduate." And, you know, they considered themselves doing me a favor by keeping me from going into debt and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, setting myself up for heartache and what have you by admitting me and me not making it. And so I finally got a letter of rejection from the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and it included an opportunity to appeal the decision. And once I read that, I sat down and I wrote the story of my life. Or, you know, I've been in front of the Nebraska unicameral and all kind of budget committees for education and, you know, higher education specifically in different states and commissions on human rights and opportunities. You know, I've sat in front of some pretty powerful and influential people. And none of that, in my mind, is as important as that two-page letter that I wrote for my appeal, right? Because without that, I wouldn't be here. And so in that appeal letter, I talked about how I grew up where I grew up. And, you know, I had to walk to school from as far as half a mile from the time I was 6 years old. In first grade, I mean, we're walking to school half a mile by ourselves, right? I had to walk 2 miles in junior high. And I had to walk in the cold, the snow, the rain. It didn't matter what the weather was, right? If school was in session, I had to go. And when I didn't go, the teachers said that I didn't care about my education, right? Because I did not walk through a hailstorm. I didn't walk through a torrential downpour or what have you, you know. And in middle school, you know, our radiators and stuff were busted in the winter, and we had no air conditioning in the summer, and we couldn't wear shorts. So if I wore shorts to school, I'd get suspended, right? If I wore a Michael Jackson shirt or a Pepsi Cola shirt or anything like that, then, you know, that was grounds for suspension, right? And so I talked about all these systems and policies and practices that were in place to almost make sure that I didn't, you know, that I didn't make it, right? And not to mention, I mentioned a crime-infested environment, which, you know, we had a lot of crime in the projects and that kind of thing. And so here I was with a 12 on the ACT and graduating from high school when a great multitude of my peers had already dropped out, right? Mm-hmm. They had already given up on school, and a lot of them were turning to crime and all that kind of thing. So I said in that appeal letter, you know, you really should be asking me, how is it that I'm still here and I'm doing what I'm doing? I'm number 33 in the class. And although that's not stellar, but, you know, in the environment that I'm in, that's very meritorious. You know what I'm saying? Because we didn't get a ride on the school bus. We didn't get a ride to school. We didn't get Socrates and Plato and Shakespeare and that kind of stuff in school. So when I took the ACT test, you asked me about all these kind of things that nobody ever told me about. You know, how are you going to assess my aptitude and my ability when you're asking me about things I've never been exposed to, you know? And so the admissions department decided that they would admit me on probation, and I had to earn at least a 1.0 GPA my first semester, and if I didn't, I was going to be expelled. And so, you know, that's the story of Brian Samuel and how I got into school. And I went in my first semester, I made like a 2.4, something like that, 2.3, 2.4. And it turns out that college wasn't hard at all. The hard part was getting in for me, just being admitted. And that followed me all through my life. When I decided I'd do a master's, I had the same problem. You know, low test scores, can't get in. And then when I decided to do a PhD, same thing. Low test scores, can't get in. I had to apply 5 times just to be admitted once to a PhD program. And so what I found, Kim, is that if you have what I call 4 D's, if you got desire, right, if you have a real burning desire to accomplish some type of goal, and a part of that desire is a why. Why is it important to you? Well, it was important to me because I was tired of, you know, the commodities and powdered milk and some of these other kind of things that we had to live off of, right? So I definitely had the desire. If you got the discipline, and when I say discipline, I mean the willingness and the ability to go to class when it's cold, go to class when it's raining, you know, go to class when you're supposed to be in class, do those things that you're supposed to do when you're supposed to do them so you can do what you want to do when you want to do it, right? If you got the determination, right? You know, a lot of my classmates in college, a lot of them went to the gym and played basketball and, you know, frisbee and hung out. And, you know, they went to college night at Six Flags and that kind of stuff, right? And it was real easy for them to kind of, you know, get off their path, right? And if you got the determination, I'm sorry, I just said determination, dedication. If you're dedicated to it, nothing is going to get you off this path, right? I came here, to get this degree. I came here to get this goal, and I'm not leaving without it, right? I'm dedicated to it. Nothing else really matters. Then you can be successful. And like I said, you know, the hard part for me was getting into college.
And then once you were there, you did great and kept moving on all the way to where you are now, where you have served in the various leadership roles around diversity, equity, and inclusion. You mentioned the evolution of the terms and the language around it, which I think is really important for communicators to know, because there's so many that have been kind of attached to the term, as if that's work. It's language. Yes, and language leads to behavior, but it's not the work. So we have to tell the story about the work and not get too, you know, crushed on the terms itself. So thank you for making that that evolutionary comment on how we talked about DEI and it's evolved over time, especially in higher education. But now you've been a leader at a couple of different universities in diversity, equity, inclusion, or whatever it may have been called. You were there. So now you're like the boss. And so how does your story influence how you approach the work and the students at your university?
It is very important to me, right? I carry those experiences with me everywhere I go. And it gives me some grounding, if you will, and makes this work, in my mind, my calling, I think, right? Because I see people from all walks of life who have very, very similar stories that need support with access, getting into colleges and universities. And I support students, whether they're trying to come to my university or other universities. But hey, I know somebody at Kansas State, or I know somebody at Ohio State or Miami, Ohio, and all the different places I've worked. And why don't you touch base with this person? Or I'm going to call them and tell them you're going to apply and that kind of stuff. And, you know, and we're going to see what we can't get done to kind of help you get in, you know. So it grounds me. It gives me some real world application and real world experience that I can leverage in my conversation and dialogues about what it means to be a student or have been a student in one of these different populations with these type of experiences. It certainly helps me relate to students, and students know that you understand and that you care and that you got some kind of experience that resonates with them to help them know that you got their best interest in mind. And even though they may not always agree or much less understand what you are advising, they can trust you because, you know, you've been through what you've been through, right? And, you know, when I say these students come from all walks of life, you know, you don't have to be Black to be first generation, right? You don't have to be Latino to be a student with a disability. You don't have to, you know, diversity. We come from so many different backgrounds and so many different experiences. And a lot of times we have more in common, right? And, you know, our experiences are overlapping in so many different ways that it's just amazing, you know, to hear some of the stories. I worked for 6 years in Nebraska, and a large part of the college going population, or the persons who were 18 to 24 years old in Nebraska, were Latino, Hispanic, Latino. And working with them, a lot of times I had to engage grandparents and parents around the importance of, you know, going to college. And a lot of those students now are doctors and lawyers and teachers and principals and, you know, doing a whole lot for themselves and their families and their communities. So, yeah, I'm very proud of what we've been able to do in higher education. We always go through these cycles, if you will, where we have to think about what we're doing, how we're doing, and who we're reaching. But in the DEI space, we've always been open to and helping students from all backgrounds. It really doesn't matter. You know, I mentioned my graduate assistantship at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga in 1993. And that was in a program called Student Support Services. And, you know, race had absolutely nothing to do with that program. You know, if you were first generation, if you were financially challenged or Pell eligible, or a student with a disability, you got to participate in student support services. And believe it or not, we were from all different racial ethnic backgrounds. You had Black, you had Latino, you had Native American, you had white, people from all over, right? And so DEI has always been about advancing or supporting the marginalized communities, right, with access and opportunity. And so I think that's still very important to the mission of higher education today, right? Because they want to educate young people and get them ready to be able to think critically, get them prepared for a global workforce, going out and engaging well and meaningfully with people whose background is different from their own. And diversity helps you do that.
And maybe that's why universities and DEI organizations within universities are trying to target right now, because we get that exposure of hearing from people and learning people's stories and backgrounds that we may not have gotten from where we grew up. And so getting that kind of exposure and seeing humanity and people that you were taught to stay away from, whatever that is, whatever that story is. I know that was, I went to a public university, San Jose University in California, where I still lecture, actually. I can't seem to leave. I did my undergrad and my graduate there, and I didn't go for the PhD. I don't have a PhD program there, what I do, but I've been teaching that for over 20 years now, and I've seen the department that I teach in, which is also where I got my degrees, the demographics have flipped substantially because the demographics of students that San Jose State is attracting has been changing, and it's reflective of how demographics are changing within California, for example. So there's no shortage of getting to know a variety of languages, backgrounds, lived experiences, cultures, et cetera. When you go to, especially that particular kind of university. So give us an idea of how is it on campus these days? There's so much focus on universities. We saw, not too far from you in Florida, was the University of South Florida, the Gators, the DEI team was let go. I've seen other, heard about universities basically reshuffle DEI teams, maybe changing the titles, but keeping them, but just keeping them within the university, but perhaps not with the titles of DEI. There's a lot of shifting and moving around. There's a lot of banning and all the things. So from your perspective and with the colleagues that you are in touch with at other campuses, how's it going? What are you talking about? And what are your priorities for the next, 1 to 3 years as you look at DEI in higher ed?
Hey, Kim here. Thanks for being here and learning ways you can build your DEI skills. And it's inevitable that you'll have questions. Maybe you're in an environment where leaders are the challenge. Maybe you're seeing employees become more divided. Maybe your company is getting caught up in the culture wars. Maybe you're just starting in this work and you're not sure what to do. Whatever your biggest challenge is, I've saved some time for us to talk. So set up a one-on-one strategy session by going to communicatelikeyougiveadamnpodcast.com.
Well, there's a lot of anxiety for sure, right? I mean, you never know if you're going to have a job. You mentioned the University of Florida, right? You never know if you're going to have a job from one day to the next in some cases. But a lot of these things are institutionally driven, right? And state driven for sure, to where, the culture of your state or the culture of your institution or your system, if you are a part of a university system, will pretty much lead the thinking and the operationalizing of how you move forward. My thoughts have all been about what we do and how we continue to support students, right? Because that, that's why we're here. That's why universities exist, right? How do you continue to make sure that students have good access to the university and that they have the resources they need to connect get plugged in, you know, belong, understand that they're welcome, right? Understand that they have a place and an opportunity to have some ownership in whatever the university offers, so that when they graduate, they are not only masters of a competency or program of studies, but they also have the ability to work well with people whose background may be different from their own. And so I see higher education as living environments, living and learning environments where, you know, laboratories, if you will, where people, you know, they get to sharpen their collective saws and their skills and their abilities and ready them for the workforce when they graduate. And if we continue to do that, then I think we'll be okay. I think, you know, I said earlier, there's no way I would be where I am today without higher education, right? And particularly that appeal letter that I wrote back in 1988. And I know without question, these United States that we are so fond of, and our corporations and our businesses that we are so proud of, right? And everything that we enjoy would not be what they are without diversity, without people who can work side by side, you know, an atheist and a Christian, for example, with different religious perspectives or what have you, but work together to solve a problem, you know. And you get that from the college experience. You get that from students being in classrooms and being able to learn from and with people whose background may be very different from their own, to where they can see some legitimacy and some value in a diverse perspective, whether they agree with it or not, right? You know, you don't have to agree with my experience coming up in the projects to know, wow, that was, you know, that was something very moving or very enriching, right? That gave me the tenacity that I operate with today. You don't have to have that same experience to see value in it, right? To see that, you know, it has played a pivotal role in my ability to be where I am today. So, you know, there's a million different emotions throughout, you know, the higher education landscape, especially for those who are working in the DEI space. But most of my colleagues, you know, they're focused on students, right? How do we continue to help students? How do we ensure that they can get in, how they can be successful, and give them, you know, the tools that they need to be successful, to learn how to work with, you know, people from different backgrounds.
Apologies, my cat has made an appearance on the podcast if you're watching on YouTube. Every once in a while, she likes to make an appearance. This is Kali, short for Kalima. Okay, so thank you. Yeah, that is the priority. And I'm concerned that if we aren't dealing with the student debt that people are incurring or are afraid of occurring, you know, if they're in high school and considering college. And then if you're like, okay, well, I'm not sure if I want to take on this debt. And then at the same time, I'm not even sure if I'm going to be safe while I'm there, because the more de-emphasizing we do around diversity, equity, and inclusion, that's very intentional and strategic within our campuses, how we're treated, the safety of all students at universities. I'm really concerned that there's going to just be fewer people, and as more and more companies don't require college degrees for roles, that what is the place of higher education? So these are the times when we need to demonstrate and really step up and show that focus towards students to say, this is the right path for many of you. And there's so much richness that comes from being in a college environment. And you mentioned critical thinking earlier. That, to me, that's one of the things that I teach, is critical thinking when it comes to media consumption, you know, kind of stories that we watch, the movies, the books, the TV shows, streaming, the kind of stereotypes that are told within stories. The Oscars was just held recently, since you and I are recording, in March of 2024. And looking at, there's, if you will, a diverse slate of candidates for, you know, Best Picture and other major nominations, and yet it was still the dominant majority that won. You know, yeah, the Osage actually performing a live song, and that there was such a variety, and yet so there's room in storytelling, there's room in critical thinking. And how we get to this place is by challenging ourselves, our intellect, and our character, and allowing ourselves to be forced in that way. And then we know how to talk about these things, and we do, because we have experience, especially in a college environment, where we have that kind of level of exposure to different stories. So for those who are students at universities right now, or high school students that are listening, people who are early in career in communications, whether it's PR or even working on the campus around communications, what role do you see communications and narrative and messaging? What do we need to be talking about and leading with as we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion? That's going to help more other audiences understand what DEI actually is, so we can counter this polarization and misinformation.
I think communication is, an effective and clear communication is very critical, right? You know, when I was at Kansas State years ago, probably about 4 years ago, one of the things that happened was the murder of George Floyd, right? And I think everybody in these United States can remember that, right? And so the Black Lives Matter movement came clearly to the forefront in a way that it had never been previously, right? I mean, not even Trayvon or, you know, Michael Brown and some of these other victims, you know, none of that did what George Floyd's murder did, right? And primarily because it was caught on camera, and, you know, the world watched it on TV and that kind of thing. And so when we think about something as simple as communication and effective communication, a lot of times people saw Black Lives Matter as verbiage that suggests that other lives did not matter. Right. You know, that's, we came up with blue lives and white lives and some of these other kind of things. And if the communication had been sharpened, all right, and this is Brian Samuel, I'm speaking from my own experience. And something you don't know, Kim, is that the police shot my father when I was 7 years old. And he shot him because he was running from the police and didn't kill him. But he blew my father's leg off, and he had it amputated from the knee and walked with a peg leg for the rest of his life. Okay. So what I think would have been wonderful is if we had helped all of society really understand what that meant when they said Black Lives Matter. In 2020, African-Americans were killed at a rate of 32 for every 100,000 in the population. Okay. By comparison, the next highest was Latino men and women at 10 for every 100,000.
That's a big
change. And then the lowest was white men and women at 7 for every 100,000. Okay. And so we're looking at all of these United States, and we know that 32 for every 100,000 are being killed by police officers. And 9 times out of 10, they were posing no threat, no threat of life, right? They didn't have guns. They weren't charging or assaulting a police officer or breaking the law to that kind of extent, right? Maybe they didn't have a seatbelt on, or maybe they were speeding, or, you know, something like that, or what have you. Something happened to cause the confrontation with the police. Okay, so that's a given. But they weren't trying to kill the police. They weren't shooting at the police or anything like that. If we had the kind of communication to help our publics that we serve, our publics that we work with, understand the disparity in those data, I think that type of communication would have been very, very strong and would not be hijacked or ignored, right? But when we say, and don't get me wrong, I do support Black Lives Matter. I'm a Black man. I've had the occasion of having a relative shot by the police and that kind of stuff. And I understand what that means, you know, and a lot of people, I think, don't have a clue of what that means, right? You know, when you look at those data and I don't know what those data will tell you today. I don't know. I like to think they have drastically reduced, right? That hopefully that number has come way down. And ideally, we wouldn't see anybody killed by the police, right? Unless, you know, they're shooting and robbing a bank or doing something, you know, threatening that way or what have you, which, again, ideally, hopefully none of that happens. But if we communicate well and we give people the data and the information that they need to really understand the message, that makes all the difference in the world, right? You know, I go back to my appeal letter and, you know, the title of this, Communicate Like You Give a Damn. Well, I gave a damn, right? And because I was able to articulate all the, you know, disparities, right, and inequities of evaluating me the same way you are evaluating others, when, you know, our situations, our backgrounds, our experiences, our resources aren't the same, right? You know, our stories aren't the same. And so it's going to be very challenging, to say the least, that you will be able to come up with an equitable conclusion and an equitable outcome when you're talking about, you know, the speed of an elephant and the speed of a shark, right? One of them is going to be faster, you know, be able to cover more distance in a certain amount of time than the other one. Now, the fact that one's in the water and one's on ground, you know, these things are important. Those are what I call differences with distinctions. You know, it's very important. So communication, effective and good communication, can solve a lot of our problems. I mean, but every now and again, you may run into some people who really don't care how well you say it, or, you know, that they don't want to believe it. They don't trust it. You know, they're dead set against it. They kind of drawn that line in the sand. But by and large, if you do communicate well, you'll be able to make some inroads.
Great. Thank you for sharing that. Where do we go from here?
I think, you know, you mentioned being humans, right? Humanistic in our nature. I was interviewed earlier last week, probably about this time last week, by a student, and she asked me some of the similar questions that you've asked, and like, how does my background and experience shape, you know, how I work and what I do? And, you know, my response to her was, you know, I came up poor. I'm Black, African-American man. I got disability, had some health challenges and what have you. And I just want to be good to people, right? I want to approach life from a very humanistic type of perspective, right? You're a human being and I'm a human being. And even if we go to different churches, even if we vote differently, even if we eat different foods on the holidays, or maybe we don't celebrate holidays at all, right? You're still a human, right? And the dignity of being a human should be enough for us to interact well with each other and treat each other with respect, right? So, you know, my plan is to keep working to support students help them get into college, because I am a firm believer in higher education, right? I think it makes a world of difference for those who will go, and as well as those who will complete, because everybody won't complete it, right? But, you know, getting in there, getting that experience, learning how to solve problems and think about things and, you know, finding yourself, right? You know,
yes.
To go back to the title of my book, I think that makes a huge difference in the quality of life that that those students will eventually have. And there's been a lot of research that suggests that if you go to college and you get a college degree, you're less likely to go to jail, right? You're more likely to be civically engaged, right? You're more likely to volunteer and work with little people, young people, right? You know, you're more likely to have good health care. You know, you're certainly more likely to earn more money over the course of your lifetime. And a lot of people, you know, that's what they focus on. But there are those other residual benefits that many cases are not as well understood or appreciated, right? So I do think higher education is the way to go for most young people, not all. And, you know, if we continue to treat each other like brothers and sisters and human beings and, you know, do what we can to help and support each other, I think we'll be okay.
I'm right there with you. Right there with you. So this question, as we wrap up our conversation, something that I ask every guest, and so I really look forward to your response to this. What does communicating like a give a damn mean to you or sound like to you?
It means standing in your truth, right? You know, if I go back to my case, I made a 12 on the ACT, right? But, you know, there were systems and policies and practices that were at minimum partially responsible for that damn 12. I often say to my wife and friends and what have you, you know, I think I did pretty well starting from where I started from. But if the education system had invested in me from an access and equity type of perspective, as opposed to a deficit type of perspective, right? What I couldn't do, I might have been a surgeon today. Right? I might have been a astronaut or a physicist or something. You know, who knows what I could have done, right? You know, I get somewhat excited by these conversations and things of that nature, but investing in our young people, helping them understand that they can do anything. And Ken, when I say they can do anything, it's real easy. You know, I just took my 14-year-old to Washington, D.C., and we went to all these different museums. And, you know, his mind is blown by Orville and Wilbur Wright and creating the airplane and that kind of stuff. And I said, yeah, that's wonderful. They did a great job. And you know, imagine what people said to them when they talked about building an airplane, right? A machine that could fly in the air and that kind of thing. But what about bottled water? Right? Somebody decided that they could sell water in a bottle. Water was already free. You could go anywhere in the world and get water for free. At any park, there's a water fountain. Any McDonald's, they give you a cup of water, right? You know, any restaurants you sit down at, they're going to bring you a glass of water. If they don't do anything else, they're going to bring you some water, right? Well, somebody decided that they could put water in a bottle and sell it. So when I say you can do anything, we pay more now for a bottle of water than we are for gas. You can do anything. And if we invest in young people with, you know, that type of mindset that they can do anything and live and dare to dream and work to be your best self and know that if you got something in mind for some type of an invention or something that you want to do it. You can do anything. I think we'd be in a much better place and further along and grateful for it, right?
Absolutely. There's some adults that could also use that advice as well, like a reminder. You can do this. You got this. How do people continue to learn from you and follow you?
For that question. I'm doing speaking engagements from time to time, for sure. And I just wrote my book, as you mentioned earlier, Finding Myself, A Journey from the Projects to the PhD. You can find out more about me and my journey and speaking engagements and different kind of things that I've done at my website, www.findingmyself.org. That's www.findingmysell.org. And it'll have plenty of information about comments or questions or, communicating with me. If you got something you'd like to say or something you'd like to ask, you could also pick up a copy of the book. Or if you're interested in booking some kind of speaking engagement or something like that, you could do that as well.
And please see it. A lot of communicators do put together events and they are looking for speakers. And your story is powerful. It needs to be heard. And we need to be looking at it from the lens as communicators to say, what are the systems and policies? And is there anything within the institutions from which we work that are participating in the withholding of access of any of our employees or any students in the early careers, internships? We need to be taking a hard look at these and giving people that permission in that space to say, go. Just go. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for spending time with us. I'm going to communicate like you give a damn.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so what popped out to you from this conversation? And I mean, it may take a minute to process, but be sure not to brush off what you just heard. Look, you just need a partner to be with you through this experience and understand what to do next. So I'm inviting you to set up a one-on-one strategy session. All you need to do is go to communicatelikeyougiveadamnthepodcast.com and you'll see the button there. The more conscious communicators in the world, the better the world. So thank you for listening, and until next time, let's communicate like we give a damn.